Welcome to Planetary Conversations. I'm your host, Warren Bell. Each week I talk with experienced and knowledgeable guests from all backgrounds and walks of life as we explore ideas and actions that can restore the health of our planet and heal our relations with one another. Check out our website at voiceoftheshoeshop.ca, and you can find all our episodes on Spotify and Apple Podcasts. But first, we openly and freely acknowledge that we live and work in Shukapmakulu, the stolen, ancestral, and unceded lands of the Suquepic people. We in the settler community have a critical responsibility to do our very best to resolve this historical injustice in a way that is satisfactory to our Indigenous friends and neighbors. One of the most divisive issues in the world today centers around the behavior of the government of the State of Israel. Now, is criticism of the conduct of that government considered anti-Semitic, or is it actually legitimate criticism of government policy and action, just like criticism of the governments of Canada or the United States? No one would consider challenging the actions of these governments as anti-Canadian or anti-American. So why is criticizing the actions of the government of Israel so easily tied into an irrational and illegitimate prejudice that goes back nearly 2,000 years? Anti-Jewish sentiment, called anti-Semitism, including the sometimes cruel and violent and murderous treatment of Jews, has a centuries-long history, especially in European countries and Russia. It culminated in the Nazi Holocaust, the deliberate and cold-blooded murder of 6 million Jews, along, it should be noted, with 6 million others. Gays, Poles, physically and mentally disabled persons, Romani people, disparagingly called gypsies, and nearly 4.5 million non-combatant citizens of the Soviet Union. Because Jews can still be targeted arbitrarily and without cause, there is understandable sensitivity in the Jewish culture to the threats of outside violence. But since the State of Israel came into existence in 1948, there has been increasingly violent repression by the government of Israel itself and its armed forces, known as the Israeli Defense Forces, or IDF, against the pre-existent Arab population of the geographic area called Palestine. Now, the violence has attained monumental proportions. Tying together prejudice-based anti-Semitism with criticism of the government of Israel is increasingly recognized as a political tactic whose purpose is to shield Israeli government leaders against criticism for their past and current actions towards Palestinian Arabs, especially in Gaza and the West Bank. Many of these actions clearly violate fundamental human rights, including political discrimination, arbitrary displacement, destruction of civilian infrastructure, violent assaults, preventing access to life-giving services like food and water, and even state-sanctioned murder. Public officials and older conservative leaders in the Jewish diaspora, that is, Jews living of the world outside Israel, especially in the U.S., have actively promoted this linkage. But not everyone, and certainly not every Jew, shares this particular approach. This conflation of anti-Semitism with legitimate political criticism has been challenged head-on by a large and deeply informed group of leading Jewish scholars, academics, and religious leaders. We're going to learn more about this challenge from our guest today. Cheryl Nestle is an affiliated scholar at the University of Toronto's New College and a longtime leader in the advocacy group called Independent Jewish Voices. She's going to help us understand what's called the Jerusalem Declaration on Anti-Semitism. And now a warm welcome, Cheryl. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you, Warren. It's great to be here.
Now, I just want to start with an issue that's very much in the news these days, and that is what's happened in Gaza over the last couple of years. I wonder if you could situate that circumstance in this process we're going to be talking about as a sort of a catalyst or trigger for changing attitudes, intensifying attitudes about what's going on in what the government of Israel is doing these days.
Well, it's been a very divisive event. we know for certain that, you know, there is a divide in the Jewish community, both here in Canada and in the U.S. It's, you know, it's a little deeper in the U.S. for a whole bunch of reasons, which I could tell you if you want. I'll just throw it out because it's sort of interesting. But one of the things that I'm originally an American. Mm-hmm. So when I came to Canada, there are things I noticed about the Jewish community that were so different from the U.S. And one of them is that the Canadian Jewish community is chronologically much closer to the Holocaust than the American community. So we have, you know, percentage-wise, a much greater cohort of Holocaust survivors and their progeny, right? Mm-hmm. So, I mean, most of the Holocaust survivors are now, you know, dying off. We won't have any soon. Right. But the proximity, I think, of the Canadian Jewish community. So there's a lot there. The sensitivity to criticism is a little bit greater. But back to your original question, which is what has Gaza done? And I think that Gaza has really deepened the divide tremendously. You know, one of the things that we hear from our friends and colleagues is within families themselves, Jewish families themselves, the divides are often so deep that, you know, brothers and sisters, mothers and fathers, aunts and they're not talking to each other because they are so divided on the question of Israel because of Gaza. You know, I think, you know, many people who are extremely, you know, sensitive to these kinds of issues have been absolutely horrified by the extent of the devastation in Gaza. And, you know, kind of understandably so, they can't reconcile this mass violence, which has been described by many institutions and individuals as a genocide, with what Israel is supposed to be in their minds, which is another question altogether.
Well, but it's a central issue. The conversation around what's happening in Israel has really intensified and spread and created not only a divide within the Jewish community, but certainly a divide in many other places, you know, cultures and settings that would normally say, well, you know, there's Israel and it's doing what it's doing. And now it's become kind of iconic as a representation of a sort of overly civilized community. I mean, a really generally civilized community stepping off the edge of what is considered normal credibility. Let's plunge into the declaration that I mentioned in the introduction, the Jerusalem Declaration on Anti-Semitism, which has been described as a response to a previous document that was put out some years earlier by the International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance. And it's very the declaration is very much a clarification of that earlier document. Why don't you describe a little bit about why a clarification was needed because of what the original document said?
Okay, so the original document is the International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance working definition of anti-Semitism, which has a long and murky history. So it was originally conceptualized by the European Union Monitoring Committee to have a rubric by which you could vet anti-Semitic incidents and include them or not in reports about what was going on in Europe. So it kind of fizzled. And it was written by Kenneth Stern, who is a well-known lawyer. He heads the program on hate at Bard College, and a few others. And it sort of, as I said, it fizzled. It was never adopted. It was the institution that had, you know, generated it actually disbanded. And then someone had the very brilliant idea of taking this definition and trying to get everyone in the world to adopt it. And what's the problem with the definition itself is a couple of sentences, which are really very hard to parse. It's almost nonsensical. And but that isn't necessarily the problem. The problem with this definition, and it went on to be adopted by the International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance, which is a transnational organization that works on Holocaust remembrance, etc. There are questions about whether it actually was adopted in its entirety, but the problem with it are these examples, 11 examples of what is anti-Semitic, and seven, yes, out of the 11 examples reference Israel. So, you know, as you pointed out, what is, you know, this interest in anti-Semitism, this focus on anti-Semitism, what does that have to do with Israel necessarily?
Yes. Yeah. I mean, it is much more of an international issue, anti-Semitism, whereas Israel is the first place where Jewish lawmakers had unfettered opportunity to make the laws and to practice those legal processes ever. It was a place where it could be done any way they wanted to. It's interesting, I was reading the other day that there was a plan to have a constitution in Israel, but there were too many arguments about what to put in it, so it never actually happened. So it's unusual that a state that would be considered modeled on constitutional principles would actually not have a constitution. But it's maybe part of this whole process of muddled thinking that kind of ends up working at cross purposes. There's a thing I would comment on is that the document that is the background document for that very simple, short, and a little bit difficult to understand working definition of anti-Semitism, the declaration is much shorter and much more focused and more concise. And is that part of the process that was needed to focus it, make it, clarify it? So why don't you talk a little bit about how it clarifies, what it specifically clarifies that was muddy and has allowed this conversation about anti-Semitism to be aligned with political activity in Israel?
Well, the definition, the Jerusalem Declaration definition is, you know, as useful as any definition at all. I gave a talk the other day and told the story because I was involved at the finalization, yes, of the Jerusalem Declaration. So at our first meeting, Professor David Feldman, who's a very, very well-known anti-Semitism scholar in Great Britain, said, is there anybody here who wants to make a new definition of anti-Semitism? And kind of, you know, unanimously, there was this kind of loud moan and like nobody was interested in doing this because it's such a complicated process. Indeed. So it really, the intention really was not to create another definition. It was to disrupt what the IHRA was going to do. So, you know, the focus I think that the JDA has that is absent in the IHRA is talking about what is not anti-Semitism. And that is the most important part of the JDA, the document. And that has been very useful as a political tool. I think it was always envisioned as a political intervention and not as like a scholarly intervention into the debate on what is anti-Semitism. That was never on anybody's agenda.
Now you, about almost exactly 2 years ago, made a presentation to the Standing Committee on Justice and Human Rights and the Canadian government here. And I went and had a look at it because it really explains sort of some of the underlying currents that led to the need for a declaration that was clarifying things. The first thing that I was struck by, you said that claims that any ethnic or religious group speaks in one voice is the very definition of bigotry and intolerance. Now, I was thinking, well, gee whiz. And then I thought about it. Well, of course it is, because it's sort of saying everybody's homogenized in a cultural group, which I don't think that's ever occurred in human history. Even very wealthy billionaires can't agree with each other. They're supposed to be controlling the world, but they argue with each other more than they argue with than the world at large. When you said that, did the committee understand what you were trying to say, that there's diversity, intense diversity sometimes within every community and certainly within the Jewish community?
Well, first of all, that was a written submission. We were not allowed to depute at the event. It was heavily stacked with right-wing Zionist spokespeople. Actually, really ridiculous. It was preposterous.
Did you feel a little like a lamb going to slaughter, being surrounded by all these fairly enthusiastic, if not aggressive, kind of critics of the kind of position you were taking?
Very hard, because a lot of their arguments are really preposterous, and you want to challenge them at every turn. And of course, I didn't have a chance to do that in real time because I could only submit a written submission because IJB was not allowed to attend. This has been a constant problem. There have been a couple of anti-Semitism gatherings on Parliament Hill that have been impactful. And we recently, at the Senate hearings, were allowed to have live deputations. And they really, I think, really made a huge difference in what people were, you know, how people understood the problem.
That seems like kind of tying your hands behind your back. Everybody knows that a live presentation, like a live concert, is much more interesting than a CD, and a piece of paper is much less captivating than somebody expressively stating things. Because you went on to say in your submission that there is no Jewish consensus on Israeli policies. There is, and you called it false and disingenuous to say that there is, which to me suggests that that's what some people were saying in their live presentations.
Yes, that's correct. And it's, I mean, when our position ever, if it gets referenced at all, it gets referenced, you know, with disdain. And what's thrown at us is that we are a small minority, you know, that we don't represent the mainstream Jewish community. I'm not going to claim to represent the mainstream Jewish community, but, you know, this divide that there are those who are pro-Israel and those who are, quote, anti-Israel, that doesn't really capture, you know, the nuances of people's opinions and feelings about Israel, about what's going on. For example, if I participate in a poll and I'm asked, how important is Israel to you? Very important. I would say very important. I am not a Zionist. I'm an anti-Zionist. I still find Israel to be, it's extremely important. My whole life revolves around challenging.
You lived there for a while. You lived there for a while.
I lived in Israel for 15 years. Yeah, so I'm not, I did my time. This is also a problem. So someone like myself who has pretty good Jewish bona fides. I sent my kids to Jewish day school. We run a completely Jewish-oriented household here. I could go on and on. You know, yeah. I speak Hebrew fluently, etc.
You paid your dues.
I paid my dues. So, you know, when I am accused of being a self-hater or a capo, you know, the Jews during the Holocaust who worked for the Nazis, it's very painful to hear. I mean, obviously, I don't internalize it. I know it's nonsense. But even someone like myself, who is completely Jewish identified, will be told to my face that I have no business representing the Jewish community, nor do I claim to represent the Jewish community. But I think I do claim to represent a certain part of it. And I, you know, just to throw this into the mix, I think one of the things that's really important to me is seeing what scholars are saying. I mean, I'm an academic, so, you know, this is where I'm always looking for, you know, the latest commentary, intervention, et cetera. And, you know, what we have now in the institutional Jewish community, in the U.S. and in Canada, but in Canada, I think it's a little stronger, is a kind of anti-intellectualism that doesn't, and that's part of that is the, you know, the transition that the community has undergone from being a kind of a space where you would have learned people, rabbis, professors, etc., contributing to the thinking about mm-hmm. how the Jewish community needs to move, present itself, whatever it needs to do. And now we have, it's donor led. It's completely, you know, the big donors have taken over from the little donors, you know, like somebody's grandmother putting a few coins in the box, to multi-million dollar donors who appear to have, you know, almost total control over the politics of the Jewish community.
Yeah, what you're actually describing is another pattern that's emerged in global society these days, and that is the overemphasis on material acquisition. So if you've got a big pile of loot in your backyard, you go around telling people that what you have to say is important, or even other people will say to you, well, you are important because of this loot, and we like it, which is tied in, of course, to the inequity between those who have and those who have not, which is another global phenomenon. So it seems to me that what you're talking about is common sense about human relationships coming up against a fixed belief. And the fixed belief is that if you're Jewish, you couldn't really do anything really bad because you've had so many, you know, the Jewish zeitgeist is filled with examples of bad things being done. And in your comment, your written comment, you said that. You said anti-Semitism is indisputable. But and then you went on to say statistical reports on anti-Semitism, which equate Jew hatred with criticism of Israel, exaggerate this threat. And it seems to me that's what you're talking about, this sort of anti-intellectualism is a kind of way of saying, just you know, this is happening. Don't argue with me. This is happening. It's bad and it's got to be stopped. What kind of feedback did you get about your remarks? There's a lot of intense thoughts and feelings and rhetoric flying around. How did your commentary that was submitted to the standing committee, how did it draw attention from other people concerned about these issues?
I'm not sure anybody even read it on the committee, right? Because you don't know how it's being taken up. I did listen to the hearings, and I didn't pick up, you know, there was no one who was referring to this submission. So I have no idea. I mean, the only thing I know is that we can see is what is being said by those who were invited. And oftentimes it's criticism of us, criticism of people like us, and what we do, based on ignorance and, you know, animus. I think that this particular submission, the content of it was not heard at all. And I don't know if anyone read it or not, or it had any influence. I mean, the very fact that we are not invited, I mean, we were on the cusp of being invited. And at the last minute we got cut. That's just happened before. So, you know, while things have improved, like we do lobby, we do meet with MPs and senators, et cetera. And we have, there's support out there. I think one of the things is, and this is true, I think, in, you know, the Commons as opposed to the Senate, and that is that there are politicians who are afraid to say they agree with us for fear of losing Jewish vote, or the party will, there will be recrimination from the party, etc. So, you know, we know in the back rooms that a lot of people are saying, particularly liberals, are saying things that we would agree with, listening to what we have to say. But, you know, the political courage to be public with that seems to be slightly lacking, to say the least.
For listeners who haven't read the two documents, the original document, and I must confess, I read them both, and I read them and I thought about them. And some of the things that are in the original would sound okay. It does say, if you make comments about the politics of Israel, it's no different from saying things about the politics of your own country, such as Canada or the United States. But there were some other fuzzy areas. Could you lay out what is the primary clarification that the declaration introduces that was not present or was too fuzzy to be clear-cut in the original working definition of anti-Semitism?
I don't think that it was too fuzzy. I think that it had very political intentions. The overall intention of the IHRA is to equate opposition to Zionism with anti-Semitism. That is the bottom line in that document. For me, what I think is very problematic is the demand for self-determination for Jews without any mention of Palestinians, without any understanding at all that if Jews deserve self-determination, so do Palestinians. And, you know, intentionally, you know, one of the people who brought the IHRA to the International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance and got it passed, Mark Weitzman, who is a big cheese at the friend at Simon Wiesenthal Center in the U.S. and very well known right wing Zionist, you know, thinker, etc. So it's not surprising that there would be no mention of Palestinian self determination. The other really important intervention is to say that if someone has the opinion that, you know, nation states are not desirable, and therefore the Jewish nation state is as undesirable as any other nation state, maybe more so, that's not necessarily anti-Semitism.
Yes.
It's really important to say that, you know, there are a variety of positions that are not anti-Semitic that say that a one-state solution is preferable, where Jews and Palestinians figure out how to live together, and that we don't separate into ethnic communities, that we don't have de facto apartheid in the country. So that's really important, that those political opinions are admissible, that they're not inadmissible, that they're not a priori anti-Semitism, and that people have to understand. So, you know, when people hear from the river to the sea, Palestine will be free. So if you're kind of on the right wing or you're, you know, a Jewish nationalist, to your ears, it's going to sound like, okay, we're going to push all the Jews into the sea and take over the land, which is not, you know, I think what the majority of people who use that slogan intend at all. You know, there are very small minority that want to eliminate the Jews from Israel-Palestine.
Well, even the phrase from the river to the sea has been part of Jewish culture for forever. Yes. It's interesting, in this sort of this swirling context around the declaration, one of the people who actually drafted the original, the working definition, the first one, Kenneth Stern, who's a well-known spokesperson within the Jewish community, long before all this discussion was taking place, back in 2019, he wrote a piece in The Guardian, and the title was, "I Drafted the Definition of Anti-Semitism, and Right-Wing Jews Are Weaponizing It." In other words, he was pulling back from his own work, saying it is being converted into something that it wasn't intended to be. Is that something that's part of what bothers you and people who say the declaration needs to be promulgated and used to correct this kind of weaponizing that's going on?
Yes. I mean, the weaponization of anti-Semitism as a charge against people who criticize Israel or oppose what Israel's doing goes back to the 70s and maybe before. So it's been in the works for a long time. And along came this incredible opportunity. As I said, it's like diabolically brilliant to have, you know, put out this definition and gotten, you know, 1,000 different public institutions to adopt it. It is, so the fact that it is taken for granted that this is an authoritative, fact-based document. You know, I had a call last year from a guy in Idaho that his city council was planning on adopting the IHRA, and he wanted help in opposing it.
Interesting.
Independent Jewish Voices is known around the world as one of the most effective opponents to the IHRA. We have, I think, done more than almost anybody else to keep it from you know, taking over. So I mean, this is people who are adopting it have no clue as to what its origins are, what its uses are. the Holocaust in the title of the IHRA is very important because it does give it a certain authority that it might not have otherwise. So people see Holocaust and, you know, I want to say genuflect, but that's probably a really bad word to use.
Not bad if you're a Catholic, but maybe it's not as good if you're a Jew.
Not a Jewish word. So there is this preordained, context in which this definition is going to be taken up, not necessarily by people who care about anti-Semitism.
Some major organizations in Canada have endorsed the position that we're talking about that's in the declaration, the Canadian Association of University Teachers, which represents 75,000 Canadian academics, so it's not a trivial organization, and it unanimously rejected the implementation of the IHR definition of anti-Semitism. And more than 40 Canadian faculty associations have done the same thing. And the statement they put out was that we reject the claim that strong criticism of Israel or even opposition to political Zionism is a form of anti-Semitism. Recent research shows that most Canadians who are critical of Israel do not hold negative views of Jews. In other words, it's a specific thing about what is done by the government and the armed forces, which of course are contingent on government permissibility. It seems to me that there's a lot of understanding of this nuance, if you want to call it a nuance, between anti-Semitism and political commentary. And it's this what Kenneth Stern was talking about, weaponizing the definition. He's saying they're just trying to smush them together to make them into one thing for political purposes, really.
For sure. Because, I mean, you know, Stephen Beller, who's written a really great book, Anti-Semitism, A Very Short History, which is one of those little skinny books, but really great.
Books are really great in general.
Yes, I agree. Lately, I totally agree. He calls it the nuclear option, right? Like when you allege anti-Semitism, it's the nuclear option. It's like the worst thing you could possibly do. Because the Holocaust, you know, is seen as the worst, you know, crime, certainly of the 20th century. But there are those who claim it, you know, even goes back, you know, in other words, it's infamy back.
The feature of the Holocaust was that it was so incredibly cold-blooded and organized. It wasn't somebody saying, I'm mad, let's, you know, kill all the people in this town because I'm so mad at them, or, you know, kill
them. Well, there was some of that.
There was the old-fashioned kind of horrible violence. But the orderly, the sort of structural nature of the Holocaust is unprecedented, I think. And therefore, you can never walk past it without paying attention to it. I want to talk a little bit about the other side of the coin, which is that there's this debate going on within the Jewish community, but it's and society at large. But the other side of this is that people who speak out in favor of Palestinian rights and against the kind of wholesale violence that has been visited on people and everything around them, the buildings, the infrastructure, the desalination plants, the hospitals. That seems to me what is the hard part. It's one thing to say, we don't like what you're doing, at the government level, but the actual outcomes that are taking place when people speak up, as you did to the standing committee, is that people who from Palestine, and many of them are having hard lives to start off with, are now, every time they open their mouths to say, we don't think this is right, it's really hurting us, a lot, they kind of get shut down. And the CAUT, the Canadian Association of University Teachers, said something about that, said even in faculties, if you're a professor and you speak up about the harms being done to Palestinian individuals and people in general, you kind of get hammered.
I was the co-author of another report called "The Chilly Climate: Unveiling the Suppression of Speech on Palestine in Canada," which was a survey that we interviewed 77 mostly academics about their experiences of having their speech suppressed or being harassed, many other things. And we found, and this was in 2021, so this is before October 7th. So, you know, the baseline for, you know, harassment and grief over having a pro-Palestine position, particularly if you were a Palestinian academic, who, according to the testimonies that we collected, you know, have suffered really the most. You know, I could quote a few things. One guy talked about he felt like when he walked into the room, it became toxic. Like everything, you know, that he felt like he was ruining the university with his position. There are many, many other examples in this, including threats of violence and, you know, repercussions, you know, like being dragged into the dean's office to be lectured or being told that you can't use, you know, for example, Edward Said's work in the kind of repression that really impacts academic freedom. And what people talked about, you know, saying, I'm not putting this into my syllabus anymore because some student is going to report me to Hillel and I'm going to be dragged, into the administration. So, you know, we know that this was going on. The other side likes to claim that it's happening to Zionists, that they're being discriminated against. But I find that really hard to believe until they produce a report such as the one we produced. I'm not going to be, and I don't want to dismiss it. I know one of the things that speaking to some academic colleagues, one of the things that's happening to students, for example, who are pro-Israel, is that they get like canceled and they get, you know, shunned by their peers. This is really antithetical to what should go on in a university classroom. So, you know, I mean, there's some bad behavior on both sides. But sorting it out is really, really difficult.
Yeah, sorting it out means you have to actually deal with the statements that are being made, the words that are being said. It's interesting. One of the people you mentioned to me was a guy named Robert Brim, who's another sociologist at U of T, and well known as a scholar of contemporary Canadian Jewish life. And he made this interesting point that some of the evidence for discrimination against Jews is arising out of saying when somebody speaks in favor of Palestine, not even mentioning Jews in particular, just saying that Palestinians deserve to have human rights like everybody else, that is considered or is counted in as an anti-Semitic act. You can't be pro-Palestinian without being labeled as anti-Israeli.
Yeah, I think that's fair. You know, the thing, this is the problem with, for example, the B'nai B'rith, which talks about itself as a human rights organization, been around for 100 years.
Yep.
They collect anti-Semitism statistics about, you know, incidents, and they publish a report once a year. So the recent report just came out. But one of the things that they did, first of all, it's very opaque. Like, so the Anti-Defamation League in the U.S., not, you know, a wonderful organization to emulate, but nonetheless, you can actually look at all the incidents that they catalog. You can look at them and judge for yourself if you so desire. We don't have that opportunity here in terms of the stats that are being collected. And, you know, just to remember that of the 6,000 incidents that they recorded this year, which is a rise from previous years, even though there's a drop in hate crimes in general in Canada, 92% of the incidents were online. So I'm reluctant to say that that doesn't matter. Of course it matters, and what people are saying online matters. And we know that from the recent shooting in San Diego where the two kids who died and killed three people,
yes,
were radicalized online. So, yes, you know, it's really hard to separate. So you get such a mix up of intentions and attitudes and politics. It's hard to like tease out like what's the real anti-Semitism and what's not. And of course, you know, one of the standard criticisms of this is that if you continue to articulate that, you know, some of the things that we think are fair criticism in terms of Palestine politics, when you allege that, you know, people who are just articulating a criticism are anti-Semitic, you're actually diverting attention away from the real anti-Semitic incidents that are going on. And it's very complicated right now. We don't know whether they're coming from the right or from the left. They seem to, you know, the more worrisome ones, the shootings into the schools, the shooting at the American embassy, the, you know, many of the ones, I'm talking about Canada in general. And, you know, the number of actual violent incidents is very low. It's something like 10.
Yeah.
But, you know, you've got these 6,000 other incidents that are being logged as anti-Semitism. So, you know, they put out a blurb that says, you know, there are 18 incidents of anti-Semitism every day in Canada. That doesn't mean that 18 times a day some Jew is getting hit in the head or pushed on the street or had his kippa pulled off.
Yes.
It means that 18 people, you know, published some, you know, objectionable post on social media, and that's being counted.
And at the same time, some of those could have been somebody saying, I feel badly about the plight of Palestinians in Gaza.
Yeah. So we don't know if they would count that. We don't know because we don't have an accounting of the incidents and what their contents are. So, you know, there are many other reasons to be skeptical about some of the numbers and the way they're used.
I want to talk a little bit about your background, because I made reference to the fact you're a sociologist. but you started off, as you said earlier, you started off in the States. In your first degree was in California. Was that was where you were? That was your home base.
Yeah, I grew up in California, in Los Angeles. So, yeah.
And what did a history degree? You could have studied any kind of history you wanted. What was your historical focus?
Modern European history.
You were stepping right into the.
Yeah. People wanted me to go to social work school, and I thought, "Are you kidding me? That's the last thing I would want to do." No, history was a very fortuitous choice for me, and I continue to be really interested in history, and my work always has an historical aspect to it.
Those do not learn the lessons of history are condemned to repeat them.
Yeah, that's correct. Yes.
Now, when were the 15 years in Israel? Because there's a long gap between your BA and your MA, and I had a notion that's where you crossed the ocean.
Yeah. So we went to Israel in 1974. Hmm. It was right after the Yom Kippur War, which was not a good time to go. People were very depressed over the ostensible loss of that war. And Golda Meir, who was the prime minister at the time, was sort of, you know, bumped out because of the way the war was conducted. A lot of people died. It was a very depressed and depressing environment to be in. But we went nonetheless. To start a new kibbutz, a new collective farm there. But it was a really difficult time. And it was a much more primitive time. And Israel is like now so technological and everything is developed in malls. And we didn't have that, you know. In 74, none of that existed.
Did it seem a little more innocent at that time?
Absolutely. But innocent, okay. So one of my first memories, so we were a group. We came as a group with a bunch of people. And we were sent to a kibbutz in the north to train, to learn skills that we would use on our own kibbutz when we moved there. So one of my strongest memories, I'll never forget it. So I was working in the vineyards. And in the kibbutz, you go to work at 4 o'clock in the morning, and then about 6:30, you have your breakfast. So we were out in the field. So there's a little shack where you prepare the breakfast. Anyway, I was walking to breakfast with one of the old guard members of the kibbutz. And he said to me, "You know who's a good Arab?" And I'm like, so naive at this point. I say, "No, who?" And he says, "A dead Arab." And this is like a left-wing kibbutz, right, et cetera. I was so stunned by that. It has never left me. So, you know, you're walking, right? You walk into, so it's not innocence. I was innocent. I'm not sure, you know, the people I was talking to were innocent. No, I don't think we ever anticipated an instance because we went there already politicized. Like, we knew that, you know, the Six-Day War had been, what, 5 years or 6 years earlier? So if you can imagine that close to that period. And our opinion at that point was like, okay, we hate the occupation. It has to end. How could it possibly go on? How could they, Israel possibly continue to be the master of a million Arabs in the West Bank and Gaza?
When you said eventually, and it was a decade and a half later, that it's time for us to leave, what was it that went from this revelation, you know, the only good Arab is a dead Arab, to the decision to leave Israel? It sounds like it was neither easy nor happy, the departure.
Either one. Very difficult, because if you leave Israel, you're considered to be a sort of a traitor or copping out or giving up. And particularly North Americans were looked on as very soft. So, you know, that nobody was surprised, you know, that North Americans would be leaving after, you know, a trial period. No, we began to realize that that society itself was deeply corrupted by this relationship. And that extended to, you know, what kind of funding schools got. You know, so we had three little kids and we were trying to think about, you know, what does the future hold for them? And what does the future hold for all of us if the majority of the Israeli population is so racist and against, you know, compromise of any sort with the Palestinians?
Very hard line. When you came back to Canada, well, you came back to Canada. Was that a deliberate decision not to go back to the States? Was that connected in any way with these revelations that were starting to play in your mind?
No, I always hated LA, so I was really glad to get out. Seriously, I don't know how to explain it, but I never liked LA. And I was happy to get out. Many of our friends who had also left Israel were living in Toronto.
And so, what was it about coming to Canada that was, I mean, L.A. fortunately doesn't define the entire American landscape, which is probably a good thing, but what was different about being in Canada? What was the change in milieu?
Well, as I mentioned at the beginning, that Canadian Jews are a much more conservative population than American Jews. So that was a real revelation for me. I didn't really understand. I'd never lived here, so I didn't really understand it. And because we sent our kids to Jewish school, because they came to Canada, Hebrew speakers, right? And from the Israeli school system, we thought, oh, it'll be a much easier, you know, adaptation if they go to the Jewish day schools and they have Hebrew around them, etc. I would not repeat that mistake if I had it to do over again, because the political and social atmosphere in the school was not compatible with our family philosophy. I'll put it to you that way. Mm. But you learned a lot. I mean, I looked around me and, you know, so my kids went to school. So if you look at Mount Sinai and Bridge Point Hospital in Toronto, they have the Hennick name. The Hennick name is, these are huge donors. Anyway, my kids went to school with people like that, so I knew the Hennicks, and they have their name on like every building in Toronto. So it is was a very, very elite population, and it was very hard for us to fit in, I think, in general. And it was a lesson that, okay, this is what the Canadian Jewish community sort of looks like, or it's one aspect of it.
Your next degree was at the U of T, so you said, okay, I'm not done with education, and it was in adult education. Now, that's you go from history, which is studying the things that have been, to adult education, the things that we need to know right now. What was that transition like for you? What were you going through in that point?
So you have to understand that in between, the place where I put a lot of my effort about 12 years was in childbirth reform. So in Israel, childbirth was very medicalized. Women were not very educated as to their choices, et cetera. So I got really involved in that. And when I was in Israel, and I was a childbirth educator for many years, including in Canada when I came here, that's the job that I did for 5 years until I went to grad school. So, you know, my intention was, I have to, number one, I was having trouble getting a real job, like a full-time job. So I'll get a second degree. It'll help. All it did was give me an appetite for academia. So, you know, I entered academia in 1992, and, I don't think I've left. You can take the girl out of academia. You can't take academia out of the girl.
What did you, adult education, what were you focusing on there?
I was focusing on childbirth reform and how how do you actually achieve that? How do you educate people so they can advocate for themselves? How do you change the system? Like the same thing I would apply to almost any other political movement that I was in. But I wound up writing my dissertation. I don't know whether you want me to jump into that. No, but I had been born again. It was I'd always wanted to go to grad school, and here I was, and it was the
right time.
The time of my life there.
The thing that childbirth education in particular, or just learning and teaching about how a human being should enter this world, should he or she enter the world with IVs and forceps and all sorts of other interventions, or in a natural way. And ironically, I trained at UBC and McGill, but then end up practicing most of my career in a small town of less than 20,000 people so that I could see childbirth. So wow. It wasn't the only thing. I wanted to see the whole life cycle. And left McGill when it was very much in exactly the state you were describing. Every mother gave birth with her feet in the air, an IV in her arm, and an episiotomy, you know, a horrible, nasty thing that doctors do to women's perineum with a pair of bandage scissors, a cut to open the space, and then forceps. And I actually had all, that was my introduction to childbirth, and coming to a small community where none of that was fostered, it was available, but it was not front line, was a hugely important experience for me, and also for relating to this very important phenomenon, how we enter, you know, embodied life on planet Earth is an important thing. So you have my vote for your choice of academic study. But then you went on further to a PhD, and that was at OISE, as it's called, Ontario Institute for Studies in Education. And your focus there was critical race studies. Now that sounds like you're getting into differentiating the way people do things in life. It's living history. What are people doing right now? What were you focusing on there, and what did you try and bring forward?
That's an interesting question. So before I started graduate school, I was the director of the childbirth education program that was run between Humber College and Women's College Hospital. And in 1992, when midwifery was legalized in Canada, all of a sudden my classes were packed, mostly with midwives who were trained in other countries, usually from the global south. So what's going on here? So they knew that midwifery was being legalized, and they were trained midwives from their countries of origin, many of them with huge amount of experience, and they were not given an opportunity to get in on this. So I thought, okay, here's my time. And I was meeting these people and having relationships with these women in my classes and hearing their stories. And I thought, okay, here's my topic. This topic chose me. This is like, you know, how they say, mm-hmm. it chose me. And it turned out to be a very, very smart choice on my part. So I interviewed 50 of these. I've interviewed 50 women. Most of whom were foreign trained midwives, several of whom were like movers and shakers in the midwifery world. So basically what I did, because I'm applying critical race theory to this phenomenon. So people would say, what the hell does race have to do with midwifery? Well, it turns out like everything. So tracking, and here comes history again, tracking the history of the emergence of midwifery in Canada, which took like 20 years, you see some really interesting historical phenomena. So, you know, it's also about identity and how one has to create an identity that is going to be acceptable in order for this huge transition from no midwives to midwives. So one of the things that characterized the midwifery movement was this kind of drive to be accepted. So these were feminists who were, you know, they were using the feminist critique in order to justify and, you know, speed up the adoption of midwifery in Canada. But in doing that, they adhered to a very white image. But not only that, so that's one element is the identity. Another element is that, you know, we know that there are thousands and thousands of healthcare workers trained in the Global South who come here, have a hard time getting into, you know, the professions that they came from. And what's going on there? So I looked at the whole question of who gets to practice here, and how does exclusion work? So exclusion worked on so many different levels. So there was that. And then there was the thing that a lot of the midwives from Canada were going to Mexico to get experience so that they could qualify to be grandparented in. So you have so many levels of racial exclusion and racism happening there here that, you know, I put it all together in a package and said, you know, the whole midwifery enterprise, as much as I support it, completely support it, absolutely for it, has based its success on a bunch of, you know, racial exclusions that have no business in a movement like this.
You know, it's funny, we are getting near the end of our time, but I'm just fascinated by the fact that we've ended up talking about something so elemental as how a human is born in this world and who is there and how it's dealt with. Because at bottom, the thing that is central to the discussion we've had throughout this program is that everybody's in the same boat. We haven't said so, but you've actually, with an interesting, what would appear to be at one level a non sequitur, brought us back to something that is basic and applies to every human being, whether they're Jewish, whether they're Palestinian, whether they're tall, short, black, white, green, yellow, you name it. We all come into this world through the womb of a woman, and there's no way to distinguish us at that stage, except by very, very limited characteristics, because we all want to be fed right now, and we all want to be comfortable in our bodies. And these sort of political issues are slicing and dicing a very small part of the human experience, because the basic human experiences are things like being born, dying, eating, feeding others, living in concert or in conflict with others. You know, these are the things that affect every human being on the planet. And so although we've focused through this hour on the issue of what's being said in the world around Jewish culture and Jewish behavior, ultimately we're talking about people who are just people and trying to live with one another in some kind of harmonious relationship. Does this resonate with you? Because it's certain when you were speaking, it resonated more and more with me as you were talking.
I mean,
about
I don't see any conflict between the work that I do now and the work that I've done all my life.
Yes.
You know, they're all motivated by the same desire for equality and fairness and justice. And I think those principles apply to childbirth in the same way that they apply
very
to
much.
Nature. Etc. So, you know, again, I don't, I mean, the Israel stuff was always lurking in the, like, you know, I was active in the years I was writing the thesis, but not as much as I would like to have been. But, you know, I was like balancing both things. And I, you know, certainly since I finished the thesis, almost everything I've written has been about Israel-Palestine. my research and everything is all about that. I was able to pivot quickly, and you know, I don't feel any conflict between these two, you know, avocations in any way, shape, or form. And I know, and there are really lots of connections. One things that I really appreciated during, you know, when Gaza was being bombarded and destroyed, was people focusing on what was happening to maternity care, and, you know, the number of babies that died and the pregnancies that were not viable because of the situation. I mean, those as you say, those things are so basic. You know, and one of the elements of genocide is interrupting, you know, reproduction. Mm-hmm. So, you know, all these things kind of can be understood as part of a whole. So, yeah.
I cannot agree with you more, because I think that is where the elemental basic characteristics of all of us come together in these inevitable features of everyone's life. So I don't see a conflict either, and I'm glad we ended up in this note, because it's sort of bringing it back to these central issues in everyone's life, which we all share, and that's probably at some point what has to happen in the Middle East, in Gaza, in Palestine, in Israel, that we have to understand that we're all the same. Because when we do, we won't be able to engage in these kinds of violent, recriminatory assaults on one another. That just won't make sense anymore.
Oh, and dehumanization is the precursor to these things, right?
Absolutely. And
we have to have this dehumanization. And the Israelis are really good at dehumanization. And some of their, you know, Jewish, you know, compatriots in the rest of the world are pretty good at it too. So, you know, and that's something we just, you know, the Jewish Faculty Network, which I am a part of, we did a report on CEJA, the Center for Israel and Jewish Affairs. Mm. We looked at 1,500 of their social media posts during the war, and identified just massive amount of anti-Palestinian racism, among other things. Mm. So, you know, this is part of how you get to consensus in a community, is by this dehumanization, and there is no excuse for it whatsoever.
That's a wonderful note for us to end the show on, because I think it's a statement that not a single human being alive can argue with, and that's always a good way to end any conversation. Cheryl, I want to thank you very much for being with us today. It's been lovely having you here and to talk about these matters. Thank you.
Thanks, Warren. Yeah, I really enjoyed it.